So I guess we should start. Welcome to this lecture on program optimization. My name is Helmut Seidel. Before I start with the lecture itself, let us perhaps briefly discuss some organizational issues. So the first thing is the language. Is everybody fluent in German? Everybody fluent in German? So too bad. Otherwise, I would have switched to German immediately. So we stick with English. Then there is this is a lecture from the master's courses. So it is still open for bachelor students in their Vertiefungsgebiet. Are there any bachelor students in here? Okay, no bachelor students. It does not require that you have already attended a compiler's course, but it would be recommended that you attended something in the area of programming languages. So there is a course on programming languages in this university. There's also a course on compiler construction. There is one of them is even running in parallel of this course. Who is attending that course? Yeah. So I talked to Axel yesterday. Axel Simon, one of the lecturers in that course, he told me that currently there is a clash in the dates in that the programming languages, the compilers thing. I think it's compiler construction. Yeah. Programming languages, so that will take place on Mondays at the same time, but he wanted to switch with the corresponding time slot for the tutorials, the exercises, and so then this would be on Friday, and so then this clash would be removed. Otherwise, I don't know whether he will record. We do record. And so you might, for the first 2 weeks or so, until this change to Friday has been settled, you may follow on Mondays this lecture by the teleteaching tool. So that is brings me just to the material for this lecture. There is a lot of material. So there's a book. We have written a book on program analysis, which is one volume of a compiler's collection on techniques for compiler construction, which has appeared in Springer 2 years ago, one year ago. There's also a German version of this book, which appeared a little bit earlier. There are, I guess the English edition is there. We already did some error corrections, so therefore this is recommended, I would say. Then there is the slides. They will be, we will make them available on the webpage. Currently there is a version of all slides, but these are from last year. Probably this year's slides will be similar, but in some parts, always changes occur and things can be made nicer, more correct, and so on. Also due to your feedback, perhaps, when I see that there's kind of, you look at me with a lot of questions and everything is completely incomprehensible, then this may convince me to give additional material, which this is not directly connected to the material, but I would like to strongly ask you to encourage you to ask questions as soon as you find something which you cannot understand, because it's better you say this immediately and I can react to it. This lecture is not so big that we cannot afford that. And it is, for me, it is a very valuable information if you ask. And it is also sometimes, maybe this does not apply to you, but sometimes I have the impression people have the fear that they might, that everybody else to the left, to the right, everybody understands and they are the only one who do not understand. This is definitely always wrong. Not asking is more stupid than asking. So asking is always a good thing. And if it is too much, I will say, oh no, this question we have already discussed twice. And then, okay, so then that was not worthwhile. But try and at least nothing bad will happen. Yeah, and hopefully something good will happen. So that is for the slides. Now, your participation in this lecture. And then there also, you see this strange thing. This is not to strengthen my voice here in this room. So the room is small enough, I hope. But record my words. And there is a lecture recording tool running in the background, which records acoustics to get the sound together with the slides, and that you will find on the TTT webpage later on. And this is, I don't know who has experience with that kind of recording tool. Has ever anybody used it? Ah, so then you know there is kind of you can kind of navigate by the slides, and I don't know whether how available that is already. There's also a keyword search, and you can even search for the words occurring on the slides. Not in the acoustics, I think that is not yet there, but in the slides. Okay, then there are tutorials and exercises and homework assignments. They are organized by Stefan, and here is his email address. And he has also, he told me that he has set up a Moodle page, and he will communicate the assignments and all these things through Moodle. What else should I say here? For the lectures, the time slots, as you have noticed, we start a little bit late on Wednesdays. I guess you prefer this against starting at 8 sharp, I guess. Or who wants to start at 8 sharp instead? Okay, nobody. And on Mondays, we start at 2 o'clock sharp also. So that is not 2:15 or something, but 2 o'clock sharp until 15:30. Okay? And that is this part of the organization. Then now you want to know how do you achieve how do you get credits? So there is it's more or less standard as in many similar lectures. There will be a written exam in the end, and so to acknowledge the hard work you invest in solving the assignments, there will be a bonus for that. So you can get, once you have passed the exam, you can get an extra bonus by means of having solved sufficiently many assignment exercises of the from the assignment sheets. Now the percentage, is there a clear percentage? Hoop, what is that? Is it? Is no more? I think, you should say it's 50%. And if it's a little bit less, then we also, so we will not take it for the, so that it's kind of measured. There are 200 points all in all, and you made only 99, then you get no bonus. So we will not do it like that. So plus minus, 50% plus minus. So minus, I mean. Okay? And so the bonus is 0.3. I guess it's not that to the next, so we are obliged to do that. We cannot just go to the next better grade, but have to stick to precise numerics. So that means in the end you might have a strange number, but this is inevitable. And there's always also perhaps the question, will there be a second chance? And there will be such a second written exam in the, at least we promise to do it in the, or we will do it in the end of the next holidays. And yeah, that is for this. And there's one more thing. You are now as many, if 90% of you pass in the first exam, and there will be only few candidates in the who need the second chance, and they, if it's too few, then it might be an oral exam. But there's, so for this second trial, there's no guarantee what kind in, about the form of the exam. Is there any question or on that? So perhaps you need a few chairs there, over there. There's some things. Even there's a chair. You might kind of, and there are there in the very back on the other side. There's still free room. No problem. So perhaps to my information, how many people are from Germany? How many Germans are here? Okay, so it's about half. How many are from the, not Germany, but European Union? Ah, so these are few. And who are from India or Pakistan? So these are some more. Now the rest? So, yeah, so, and Can you say where are you from? Yeah. Where?
Brazil.
Ah. So who's from Latin America? Ah, so there are some more. Okay. And the remaining parts, can anyone just for Egypt? Ah. And you?
Turkey.
More Turkey?
Ah.
Bangladesh. Hmm?
Bangladesh.
Iran. And where? Also Iran?
China.
China. More Chinese?
No.
And you?
Sri Lanka.
Sri Lanka. Uh-huh.
Korea.
And how did you learn about TUM? Did you kind of search the internet or and then apply, or how did you do it? On the internet. And you had to kind of pass kind of a test. And did you were you exempt by someone?
Yes, that was professor. We did a Skype interview.
With a Skype interview, okay. Okay. So then, and you will stay. Will you stay for those from these far countries? Will you stay for until your master's? Is this your plans? Or is there any other? Will you only stay for a year or a semester? Complete master. Okay. Then let's start. So now what is the that was the organizational issues. Was there a question? No. Now about the content. So there is, so it's, some parts of it are very classical. So here it is about the optimization phase of a compiler. So as you all know, compiler takes your program, which you wrote, and then you hope that the compiler does some magic things, and in the end, some code is produced, which runs incredibly fast. So and now, so if the compiler does not invest smart ideas, this will virtually never be the case. So typically, if the compiler is stupid, the result, at least if your program is not, if your program is completely stupid, then the compiler has no chance. If your program is decent, then the compiler has a chance, but the compiler has to do something. And here, this lecture is about what the compiler has to do there to make your program fast. And so there is some kind of strategies which the compiler applies to achieve this goal. And so some of these are kind of philosophical. Like these ones or these ones. And the concrete realizations of these philosophical principles will be discussed here in detail. So now, perhaps before kind of pointing to that and giving you an example, perhaps one kind of fundamental theoretical argument. So if you have in some sense, you write your program, and in a certain sense, this is the specification of what you want to do. And the ideal compiler then could run through all programs in the world which have the same semantics as your program and take the fastest. And that would be the best compiler you could hope for. And then you have the optimal solution to your problem. But that is kind of impossible for several reasons. Do you know any reason why this is might be intractable?
Well, to go through all the solutions, you'd need infinite time.
Yeah, so there are so many other programs to look at.
Computationally impossible to determine whether two programs are identical.
Ah, so that is another point. Even if we... a benevolent, a spirit offers us another program, and then the compiler should be able to check whether this program, the original, the specification, and the one given as a solution, whether they have the same semantics. And this check for equivalence is for theoretical reasons, impossible. So it is not decidable to find out whether two programs you may recall there is something like Turing machines. It's very simple kinds of programs. Even there, it is undecidable. And real programming languages like Java are a little bit more complicated than Turing machines. So this does not mean that it's easier, but even more complicated to decide whether two Java programs do the same thing. So in that sense, it is, so now we could say, things are hopeless, we should give up and study something else. So that would be one possibility, but that is kind of the challenge of a scientist, not to give up so quickly, but to see whether one kind of, maybe the problem or the question is kind of ill-posed. So if we go for the very best thing, so to be so ambitious, then we will fail. But maybe there are some more down-to-earth things which kind of can be done. And the compiler is a down-to-earth thing, so it does something and hopes to get by that benefits. And in that is a very successful strategy. And so, for example, one idea is not to find the best program which solves the same problem, but to just improve the given program. So, and now to improve it means, what does it mean? It means to identify things which are inefficient in your program and replace it by more efficient things. So one thing is clearly if you use the wrong algorithm and then use a better algorithm, would be replacing one thing by another thing. But this is more on the hard side because algorithms are very complicated, and the compiler is typically too stupid to see, these weird lines here are an implementation of bubble sort. Yeah, so that would be something, and then replace it by heap sort. Yeah, that would be great if a compiler could do it, because many application programmers have not carefully listened in these basic computer science courses and use stupid sorting algorithms, and that is responsible for a lot of slowdown in application systems. Because for some reason, the application programmer thinks, it's only 20 things to sort. I do it with insertion sort, And then it turns out it's hundreds, and then it kills. This stupid sorting algorithm will kill your application. And things like that happen, but that is already on the side where the compiler is no longer able to do that, because you can write a sorting routine in many ways, and the compiler is not able to do it. Typically, the compiler looks for more simple inefficiencies and tries to replace them. So one of these principles is this one, that the compiler identifies that something is computed which is never used or is already there. And then that is would be a kind of redundant computation. If the compiler identifies this, then this is clearly a thing which can be removed without changing the semantics of the program, and therefore that is a good thing to do. So this is one. There are several instances of this general principle which we will see. So another thing is, okay, a certain computation is not completely useless, but is can obviously replaced by something cheaper. Well, this replacing one sorting routine by another is of this kind. But this is, so there are also less high level but more low level instances of this principle, and we will look at several of these. And then another very important class of things what a compiler can do is the compiler has kind of built in the knowledge about the hardware. And the programmer does not so precisely know the details of the hardware. The programmer does not know that. He only knows about the application. And so the, in that sense, this is also a separation of concerns. At least in an ideal world, it would be nice if the programmer could be kind of liberated or freed from the from all the concerns about the hardware. He only writes things about the problem and the programming language and writes his program, and the rest is delegated to the compiler. That would be great. And to a certain degree, this still works today. But the world is changing rapidly, and this kind of paradigm of separation of concerns is currently, I would say, slowly dying away, because now hardware has extra features which have to be taken care of already on the application programmer side. So like if there are multi-cores or you have very irregular architectures now around, and then to ask the compiler alone to make efficient use of all these possibilities is a bit to ask for too much. So in this sense, but still there are even if the programmer has to kind of support the compiler in making optimal use of the hardware, still the programmer does not want to care about every detail. The programmer does, for example, does not want to care about how many registers are on the machine. So this is clearly something which he does not want to reason about. In particular, if you want to have portable code, which is which may run on this generation of processors, but also on the next one, and then you cannot adapt your program too tightly to the hardware. So therefore, here is a wide area of demands for the compiler to do this final step. So the last mile, it's less than a mile. Typically, it's very small to the real hardware. And that is, there are a lot of facets there, and this is an ever changing and challenging field, because the hardware changes very quickly. So there we will speak a little bit about that also. Okay, so that is about the general outline, what we will have in this course. And now perhaps kind of to convince you that there are inefficiencies in the code, even if we write very simple programs. So, and it is even so that consider, for example, this little program, which could be a routine swap. So it exchanges in an array A the entries at indices I and J. Yeah, so very simple. It could be part of a quick sort or something in Java. Yeah. So how would we write it? Well, first we would have a temporary. And this temporary would be used to because if we exchange these values at I and J, we have to kind of store away, for example, the value of AJ. And then override AJ, and then put T into A of I. So that would be the exchange, and we would, if it's part of a sorting routine, we would do that only if the value of I is, say, greater than the value of J. Yeah. So it's very natural program to write, very short, and what could we do else? So that this seems to be optimal. Huh? Is there any inefficiency in this program?
The address of the memory is computed multiple times.
Ah, so the address of the... Yeah, so in that sense, if you think of Java, there is no real other opportunity, other chance. So you have to do it in this way. So if it's in C, one might think, the addresses of... A of I and A of J are computed several times, and even the same value is loaded several times. So it's computed, is accessed, this memory cell is accessed several times. Here it is accessed for the comparison. Here it is accessed another time, just for storing away. And that, so in this sense, one could say, okay, so there's a lot of things which is bad here. Ah, so that if the processor is smart, if the compiler is smart to use this, and then one could use such a swap instruction if it is available on the processor. But here in the programming language, there is no possibility to do this swap, so we have to write it like that. And some programming languages, like Java, you have to do it in this way, with this multiple occurrences of this indexed access. In other languages like C, one would have other possibilities. In C, and so the hardcore C programmers would never write that, or perhaps would not write it like that. They would use, they traverse arrays by pointers, and by that they could kind of, if they use a value several times, maybe they kind of decide to store it away in some other variable. So that would be kind of the C programmer's version of this swap routine. And you see here, there are, now you receive here not indices, but pointers. And you have several temporaries for storing the values of the, for caching, if you like, the values in the array to which are looked at. And so these values could be kind of loaded here, then used in several times, and then stored away in the through the addresses which have been computed only, which have been not computed but kind of passed to the routine. That would be kind of what the C programmer does. But on the other hand, if you think of that the program is should be pleasant to your eye. Well, why should it that be? But typically, you want to understand your code later on when programming is over, and you have to kind of maintain your code. And then it is clearly you prefer to look at such a program where you see explicitly, it is the array A, and I exchange the indices I and J, and so that is kind of the thing which you want to write. And this is perhaps the thing which, or the analogon of which the compiler should then produce from it. So that is kind of the idea. We want to have nice code because we have to maintain. It's not only the compiler who has to read the code, but you also have to read the code when you later have to understand or hunt down bugs. And then it is better to have a clear program, no optimizations of this stupid form, but delegate that to the compiler. Yeah. So we want to have intuitive programs, and which do not kind of go too detailed use of the hardware, but abstract from it, and then want to have the compiler to compensate for that high level programming. And that is, here in this case, it is about using addresses instead of indices, using temporaries instead of repeatedly accessing the memory. So that was the things which we saw in this program. But there are more things which are necessary if you want to make efficient use of the hardware, which also should not be done by the programmer, which is, for example, you have suggested that to use special instructions like this swap if it is available in the hardware. Or there are other things like in some cases, or you all know that modern architectures typically are pipelined, and pipeline only wants to have linear sequences of code. Now, but you have conditions and you have loops. And then what can we do? And there is something like the hardware is kind of happy if it at least knows in advance that there will be a jump somewhere. And then there is something like a delay slot. This means you have to announce the branch before you do it, or the jump before you do it. So the next instruction is again executed. So this is kind of these delay slots. Again, something which the ordinary programmer does not really want to care about. There are more things which the programmer does not want to care about, but which is important for the efficient behavior. Namely, there is typically accesses to main memory are extremely expensive. So the main memory which is available in modern processors is growing, and we see the numbers. 8 gigabyte or something, we are very happy. But this is not so that this is cheap memory. This is not this is not so cheap. Perhaps it's cheaper than a hard disk, but it's not really cheap, not compared to the processor speed. So therefore, all these data, in order to get have the processor occupied all the time, you need the data which can be accessed very rapidly. And that is, for that, there are all these caches. And there are various kinds of caches. So there's a cache, often there's a cache for instructions separately, so for the programs, for the program itself, because the program is also large. And so you have to access it. And the parts of the program which are executed again and again and again should reside in that instruction cache. So this means that, for example, loops should inner loops where a lot of time is spent with should be small, or at least small enough to fit into that cache. This is something which we would like to have the compiler do for us, by splitting loops into such small ones, or kind of removing things out of it so it's small enough to fit into the cache. or the, for the data, if the data structure is too large, that at least the iteration is in such a way that it kind of so that at least those portions which are used in the next few steps or iterations fits into the cache or is already in the cache when it is accessed. So these are very important, crucial things. If a program has bad cache behavior, it is incredibly slow. And then there are other things which we can, in some sense, not always avoid. So there is one particular ugly thing. One would not believe that this is such a big problem, but it definitely is. This is the range checks for array accesses. So it is a well-known nuisance with C programs and a famous cause for many vulnerabilities of programs. What is there? The idea, in some sense, you kind of force the runtime system to access, to kind of use an index which is not among the indices of the array, and so you access something else. Or you write to a place somewhere else, and by that perhaps overwrite some parts of your call stack, and then suddenly jump to another place where something interesting happens. So that is a behavior which in C you have to care. It is a matter of the programmer to care for it, that such things do not happen, and so the programmer is usually not trustworthy, and so things happen like that. Also, I would say in modern software development, people are aware of that, and I know the people from Microsoft, for example, explain that they have a lot of techniques to kind of just catch these kind of bugs and to have precautions for it. So in that case, there is for C, I would say these professional, at least in these more prestigious companies, they are aware of this problem. I guess many small companies are not aware of it and they don't care. But those companies like Microsoft who suffer from bad press, they care. But in other languages like Java, it's not up to the programmer. The programming language cares for it. So this is nice because you don't have these buffer overruns, but it is bad because you have to check for it all the time. So the runtime system has to, at least if no extra effort is invested, the running time decreases because you at any of these accesses of the array A in our little example, there would be checked whether I or J is in the range. Although it is always the same I and the same J, there would be always again and again the check generated by the compiler, the runtime check, that I is within the range of admissible indices for the array A. Which is stupid, because in some sense you only have to do it once, and then later you know. And that is kind of an optimization which we expect from the compiler. Yeah? Or the compiler knows that the array has size 5, and perhaps has information about the values which I and J may take, and then no check at all must be generated. So these are kind of things which are inefficiencies or problems which may arise and where the compiler can help. And then these program optimizations and compiler transformations to improve the code have been part of compiler technology since the very early days. And the very early days were when assembly programming was replaced by Fortran and COBOL and such things, but I guess more in the Fortran area. And there already people kind of, Fortran is, some would not consider that as a very high level language, but at least it's more high level than assembly code. And already there were all kinds of inefficiencies and people started to improve the code. And these people there were engineers and they did not really care, or the notion like semantics or correctness of something, this was not their concern. And so a lot of program improvements were suggested, and then only the hard way people realized that by improving the code not necessarily preserves the code, but it may simply destroy the semantics of your program. So the compiler in best effort does something, and then in the end the program computes something completely different, or at least in some ways different from what the programmer expected. And this is not really nice, because usually the programmer trusts the compiler and writes the program and then let it run, and then is amazed when something strange, a strange result happens, because then the programmer tries to hunt down the bug, and it looks, I would look everywhere, but I would at the very last moment think, maybe the compiler is wrong. And so these compiler bugs are not so easy to find. On the other hand, if the compiler is used heavily, then typically there are not so many compiler bugs. Well, okay, so here's an example of such an improvement, which you could kind of, which seems at first sight plausible, but it's not necessarily plausible. So for example, if you call a function twice, and the function is perhaps complicated, and then you might say, this is stupid. It's better to call the function only once and then multiply with 2. Yeah, so that would be something like in our little specification, we could say this is redundancy elimination in a certain sense. One call is redundant. Or you could say we replace an expensive computation by a cheap one, namely, we replace evaluating the function f by multiplication with 2. So this is a good thing. And I do not even bother you with asking the question why this need not be always correct. And because the f could do anything, and it could also have a side effect. It could kind of increment a counter in the background. And so in this sense, it might make a big difference whether f is evaluated once or twice, and therefore this is a good thing to do, but only if we know more about the function f. It's not, yes. Yes, if the language is functional, this could be right, because then the function f might not have a side effect. But this only is true for a pure functional language. So if you have a language like OCaml, which is nice, and one common sense would consider that as a functional language, but it might have side effects. Or functions might have side effects. So in that sense, one would need extra information about whether functions can produce side effects or not. Or maybe they compute, they may have side effects, but they are harmless for some reason. Okay. So from that we conclude that if we apply an optimization, if we have dreamed up a transformation which seems to be good and improve the code, then we should be aware that these transformations often have assumptions which must be checked beforehand, like here, whether functions have side effects or not. And in some sense, it is sometimes a boring but important exercise to formalize, to make precise what the assumptions are. And already this might often help to clarify what's going on. And then, if we are convinced ourselves that these assumptions are sufficient to guarantee that the transformation will not destroy our program, then we kind of have, in order to apply the transformation, we then have to check beforehand that the assumption is met. Or we have to insert a runtime check. This is also possible, that checks at runtime, and then we kind of make two copies of the code, one which is optimized and another one which is not optimized, and then check at runtime whether the conditions are met to use the faster version. So this is also not completely... this is also an interesting alternative if the compiler has not enough information to decide whether the transformation is possible, but the transformation would be so so great, the improvement would be so great, so that it is worthwhile to kind of create a version of the program which is so fast, and then decide at runtime. Okay. And then, in the end, if we take the business very serious, we should also prove that the transformation which we apply will preserve the semantics. So here in this lecture, we will not do a lot of these proofs, correctness proofs, but at least give a hint that something must be done there and how that would look like. And we will invest a little bit effort kind of to show you the kind of reasoning which you have to do if you want to know how to describe assumptions on the code so that you can apply the transformation. But we will in particular, and that is kind of the practical side, we will provide algorithms which kind of infer information about the program, which allows then later to trigger the optimization. So this is what kind of has to be built in, this checking and this analysis of the code. This is a crucial part of this transformation phase. And we will have kind of general methods how to do that in an efficient way. So then, few general principles which I showed you in the very beginning, they are kind of philosophical and they can be applied to any language. But if it comes to the concrete optimizations to be applied, then clearly, this is kind of a trivial statement, they depend on the programming language. As we have seen, in Java, we have no other choice as writing this. Well, okay, so we could use a temporary and load values from that we could do, but we have no possibility to speak about addresses of memory cells. We only have to use arrays and indices to access. So in that sense, the programming language every programming language has its advantages and so on, but also its deficiencies and particular demands for the compiler. So this array-bound checks for business, for example, this is a point, and removing these, this is a thing which we have to do for Java. We do not have to do it for C because there is no built-in array-bound check. Yeah, so the programming language determines what kind of inefficiencies are there. The programming language, every programming language has peculiarities which makes it easier or more complicated to reason about the program. So if the programming language is very simple, then the reasoning about the program is easier. If it has a lot of features, then reasoning about the program is difficult. So, for example, reasoning about a C++ program is extremely hard because there anything can happen in principle. While And also Java is a monster, but what people there typically do is they use a kind of compiler to produce bytecode, which is more or less a simplified version of the original program. And then they analyze the bytecode. So that is what people do there mostly. And the more features the language has and the more complicated the semantics is, the more difficult it is also to prove that what one has, that the optimization is really correct. So for Java, for example, so if we check what are the inefficiencies, then we have found these array bound checks. This is clearly something, but there are other things which makes life, makes runtimes in principle slow. So for example, there is this thing that everybody likes to use methods and call methods, but the default is dynamic method invocation, and this means that at runtime, the runtime system searches for the method to call, and so this means it starts at the current object, and then it looks whether there's a pointer to a description of the class, and then it looks, is this method available in this class? If not, then it goes to it follows another reference to the superclass and searches for the method there, and so on. And this is, at least if your class hierarchy is not completely trivial, this is a longish process, which can be optimized and is typically optimized. But there is some work to do there. In principle, this is expensive. Also, there is the object organization in the organization of objects. The internal representation of objects is kind of, there's a lot of convenient things in and stored in an object, which might not always be available required. For example, every object provides support for these concurrency features. So it allows you to synchronize on every object which you like. So any object could be used for it. So every object in principle must provide the machinery for that. But on the other hand, this possibility is used only rarely. Not every object, but only very few objects are really used for synchronization. And then the others have all this overhead. And that can be kind of stripped. This is another thing which comes to my mind, at least. And I guess there are more of these kinds of things in Java programs. And not all of them are stripped statically, but what they do is they have these runtime JIT compilation thing, so that they kind of observe the behavior of the program and then optimize the program on the fly, depending on that optimization. This is also a very interesting technology, and this is the reason. So they have this advanced compiler technology. Without that, Java would be incredibly slow and not so as successful as it is, because I guess if you write a program, you usually do not observe this bad behavior. On the positive side, there is what you find in Java is there is no pointer arithmetic like in C, which kind of heavily obfuscate the behavior of the program. There's if you have a stack and something is on the stack, then you can only access it when you come back to that method call. But this is not the case in C, for example, where you can kind of use tricky things to have dynamic data structures in the runtime stack and such beasts. So that's kind of weird things you can do in C, which makes life there hard. But on the negative side, I should make that in the black thing. So Java is very, in some sense, also very dynamic. because it supports even the classes which you have in your system is not static. You might dynamically load extra classes. I think you can even override existing classes by that. So you can never trust precisely what kind of set of classes, work set you have. And there is possibilities to reason within your program about the program. So you might inspect an object, ask what class are you, what methods do you support, and so on, and then use that. And I guess, do you know where they use this these reflections severely? So these, I think these Java beans, and in this beans framework, they use this these reflection things. These are kind of adapter things, which allow to kind of this kind of generic framework to connect to arbitrary classes. And so they look at these classes and see what is in there. Support the framework. That is, do they provide the right methods? And that is, therefore, this reflection thing in some sense is very nice and convenient for programming, but very bad for the compiler. And then there are other things which kind of may obfuscate the behavior of programs. This is if you make heavy use of exceptions, and a lot of control flow is through exceptions, then the behavior of the program can be quite irregular. And then there is another thing, which is threads. And if several threads interact, it's difficult for the programmer to predict what will happen, and it's also difficult for the compiler. And so the compiler must be very conservative, is typically very conservative with respect to threads. In that sense, there is even this, which is currently a very hot topic in code generation, compiler construction, and program verification. This is this weak memory model thing. Has anybody heard about that? Weak. I write it down. I don't know whether you can read it. But at least, I don't know whether later on this, if you search the slides for weak memory model, whether my handwriting has been passed by by the automatic character recognition thing. I guess not. So what is it? So the problem is, due to the caches and to the when you make a write, it does not mean that you write, because it may be in a write buffer. And when then another thread reads from that very same location, it will perhaps read the old value and not the value you have written. And so the ordering in which writes and reads from memory locations are observed does no longer very tightly correspond to the timings at which these writes and reads have happened. And this is the thing with the weak memory models. And then there's another thing that there is, I guess one of the intentions of these weak memory models is to, well, they describe the minimal guarantees which must be provided by the runtime system and the compiler and everything. And they made it weak in order to allow for more compiler optimizations. Because that is another thing. It could be that reads and writes inside a single thread may have been rearranged by the compiler for some reason. Then these memory models have been kind of adapted to make these kind of rearrangements correct. Also, they kind of destroy in some sense, the behavior which you might expect when trying to look at the source code and trying to kind of produce sequences of reads and writes extracted from that, and compare that if you have multiple threads and see what happens then. And this is what you kind of on paper then expect might not be that what you observe on the real hardware. This is kind of, why is this so? The reason is to kind of produce only behavior which is to that what you kind of see on the piece of paper gives the compiler and the runtime, puts a lot of pressure on the compiler and the runtime system. And pressure in that sense that it must obey so many restrictions that no optimizations at all are possible. And then people have decided, so it was not my choice. They have decided for efficiency and against clarity. So the semantics, what really happens is no longer very clear from the program code, but the code is very fast. So in that sense, it is kind of a dubious thing. But that is, there's another issue in this same area. This is these log-free data structures. So they want to have data structures where there is which run extremely fast and do not block the threads which access these data structures. Otherwise, thread communication incurs a lot of blocking and waiting and slowing down. And they wanted to get to allow for faster data structures. Yes, your question?
So just so I understand correctly, the weak memory model just omits the write back into the shared memory after every operation. So you write back the memory to the memory at any point later after
yes.
Everything finished and not after every operation.
That is the behavior of the behavior of the hardware is like that, that there's not always a write through, but typically only a write to a buffer, and also a read, sometimes also a read from the buffer, and not the read from the memory cell. And so you read from the buffer, also somebody else writes already in some other situation. So in that sense, the memory, a few of different threads. So this only matters if you have several threads, is not necessarily fully consistent. So you can enforce full consistency by hardware things like fences or software things if the programming language does not support the fences, but you can by software things like locks. If every access to a global is protected by a lock, this weak memory model thing will not bother you. There's no problem with that. It only occurs if you are so enthusiastic about efficiency that you try to avoid the locks. And this makes the semantics very brittle. And I would not recommend that. Besides, you very carefully know what kind of guarantees the compiler and runtime system really gives you, and using that only in the very, very small components, just implementing a single data structure in this way. And then everything around should again be in a well-managed version. But this is again a consequence which makes it a consequence from the new kinds of architectures, processor architectures, which have arrived and try to improve, to increase a processor speed or processing speed. But since the sequential execution cannot be accelerated much more, so they go to all kinds of parallelism. And on the other hand, yeah. And if you kind of in a very naive reluctant way, if you use this parallelism in a reluctant way and use always locks, then the parallelism will not lead you very far. That is difficult to make such statements. It depends what kind of applications you have, but sometimes at least to be to make a not so bold statement, but sometimes people have the impression this is the bottleneck. We need to, we have to kind of get rid of synchronization as much as possible. And then they go, they have to at least consider these weak memory models when they design data structures without locks. Yeah, but to reason about these data structures is extremely difficult and very error prone. Yeah, so, and that is, yeah, in this sense, if you have such, if you go to this thing, to this multi-threading without locks, then reasoning about programs in Java programs is extremely, extremely hard. Also, if you go for the high level, if you try to reason about the semantics of high level Java with all the features, then clearly it is again difficult, and the solution there is that people go to this bytecode, and there are all, a lot of these, at least the majority of these features kind of has been already transformed away. So for example, at least, I don't know whether this changes with the next version of Java. One thing is, for example, these generic things. Generics have been on the bytecode level, there are no generics anymore. And then there is another thing which makes real life, if you want really to want to know what your Java program does, is then typically Java programming is not programming everything from scratch, but make the appropriate use of libraries. And it's not so clear what libraries, what the semantics of these libraries is, and even from one version to the next, the semantics may change. So that makes things not easier. So what will we do in this course? So now that I have shown you kind of, or the kind of described things in this area here in this course, we want we are concerned with we try to learn the basics, and so a high level language is great for the applications and for the programming and for writing a real compiler, but for teaching and learning it is a complete mess, because then you are mainly concerned with looking in the very details of Java, which is interesting in itself. But it kind of obfuscates the basic principles. Therefore, we go for an extremely simple language. So we kind of go to the opposite range of potential programming languages, namely a small language which is imperative. So it has variables, it has assignments to variables, it has a memory and a memory access, and a memory write also. It has go-tos and it has if-then-else. So in some sense, it is virtually, we see nothing, we do not even see procedures. Later we will add procedures. But on the other hand, this kind of language is not completely useless. In some sense, you can view it as an intermediate language, where you almost virtually everything can be compiled to that. And many compiler frameworks provide such an intermediate language. So, for example, there is this very popular compiler framework, LLVM. Who has heard of that? Ah, so some of you. So they have also an intermediate language. And that intermediate language is, well, it is a bit different from that, but in some sense it is also a very simple one. It has some more features. This is kind of the core of such intermediate languages. And the variables here you could view as program variables, but you could also view them as kind of things which you might want to put into registers. While here in this language, so while registers, as you know, there is a limited number, I don't know, so in different architectures, these numbers may vary, but here, so this intermediate language, in this sense, allows you to use arbitrarily many variables, And then, but they still kind of, you should keep in mind, they are meant to be mapped, or they are candidates for things which can be put into registers. And later we have to dream up techniques how to do this mapping, whether we can store everything in registers, or what do we do with the variables which we cannot store in registers. Yeah. Okay, and when we want to deal with procedures, for the moment we could consider that we would then add an extra statement for procedure calls or function calls. Okay, now for this intermediate language, so we might kind of make a simple basic check whether we can express the swap, the body of the swap function by, or the swap procedure in this little language. So we can do it, and here is how it would look like. So here I try to make explicit every step, which kind of you can think of that there is a kind of vanilla code generation, which kind of syntactically goes through the program text or the internal representation of the program, which typically is a syntax tree, which kind of traverses this program text and then just outputs a piece of code for everything action which has to be taken. So in this case, we have to, what do we have to do? Yes, the first thing is we have to compare this AI with AJ. So this means here we first have to determine the address of the ith memory, the ith entry in the array A. So this could be done here. And then here we compute the address of the jth entry, and here we kind of do the loads. And here, for every new value which is produced, I have introduced a separate intermediate variable. So this might we might wonder whether it is necessary to use always a fresh intermediate variable, or whether we could do reuse something. Yeah, but for the moment, in the vanilla code generation, we use fresh. Or we could, a strategy could be to use fresh variables whenever necessary. Yeah, then here is the comparison. We compare the two values which we have read. And then if something has to be done, so if the ith entry is larger than the jth entry, then we do something. And this means in this vanilla code generation scheme, we would kind of have to access the value of j again. So we again have to compute the address, have to do the memory access, store in t. And then we kind of here compute. Then we have to again. Then we have to generate code for the assignment of to AJ the value of AI. So we have first to we first compute the L value, so the address of the entry AJ. So this is here. Then we have to compute the value of the right-hand side. So I make it, so the colors are kind of maybe a little bit. So this is here. And then we use this value, which we have then computed for the right-hand side in the register R3, to make the assignment to the left-hand side, which is we store in the location A4, the value R3. Yeah? And then afterwards we do the same thing. We store in the ith entry of the array the value T. So this happens here. So it's in some sense, you see, this is once again, this is the vanilla code. And now comes the optimizer and tries to look at it and see, can I do is what is superfluous? And there are a lot of things which now we can do. Yeah, and what the compiler would do. So the first thing is, well, that is a little bit ideal. I have kind of assumed that addressing is word-wise, but if it is, it could also be, if it is byte-wise, then this one could also be a 4 or an 8, depending on what kind of architecture you have. Yeah? So in this sense, this is all over the place here. It is, I wrote 1, but it could also all be 8. But if it were 1, then one could, one trivial thing is that that this scheme here has generated, because it's just stupid and just based on the syntax. So therefore, it generates stupid things like 1 times something. And 1 times something is the same as taking something. So this multiplication is useless, and we should remove it. So we kind of, that optimization then would be this one. Okay, so this is the first step. It doesn't help very much. But at least it improves the code. The next thing is that we find that a lot of, that the addresses, all addresses which are computed fall into 2 groups, namely those addresses which refer to AI and those addresses which refer to AJ. I don't know whether I have kind of said that in the right way. The group with A1 is for the I and the other ones are for the J. So we have these equivalences. And that is kind of something which we have to, the compiler has to find out. And he will find it out. We will later see if the compiler is strong enough to find that out. And then we have this repeated memory lookups. So because the same address here, the same address here and there is used for memory lookups. In some sense, we would like, and so there are 2 memory lookups, and the question is, will they be the same? Now that is not so, this is a little bit subtle. Why? Yes. This is not, memory is something which is not so much under control as for, as these variables. For the variable we see in the code, here is a write to this variable. Memory is kind of indexed, or there is an address, and in some sense, in order to make sure that really 2 memory accesses are the same, we must make sure that the same address is not, this address is not written to. By no means of any other part of which could have been executed in between. Yeah. So this might be in general. This is not so easy to guarantee. In our case, it is very easy to guarantee. At least if there's no thread running in parallel, namely there is no write at all. And so if you do access the same address twice, we will get the same value again. So in this sense, we are here on the lucky side. Yeah, and that's not only here the case, but it's also there the case for the other 2 things. And this means that certain registers also are the same. In this case, R1 and R3. Why? R1 receives the value from this one, and R3 this one, because A5. And A1 are the same, the memory lookups will produce the same value, therefore R1 is equal to R3. So this we expect the compiler to find out. And then the code has suddenly shrunk dramatically if you apply these informations, this information which the compiler has computed. And you see now, this looks now much nicer, the address A1 and so there are only 2 addresses which are computed. There are only 2 values which are, so here, only these addresses are computed. Only these values are computed. And that's it. So in this sense, this is very good. some more thing. Here one even sees that this this R2, if you like, the R2 runs into the T, and to in the T flows into that, and we might even, instead of using this T, we kind of shorten this chain of assignments and directly use the R2 to as the right-hand side here, and by that remove the T. Yeah? This could also be done by the compiler. And then, if you look then at the code, it is more or less exactly that what the C programmer has by tedious pointer chasing and so on implemented. And so in this sense, if the compiler really does it in this way, then we would have the advantage of writing a high-level program and also the advantage of an execution which is as efficient as we had hacked C. Yeah, so that would be kind of the dream. And this is, at least so far, the dream is really, this is realized by the compiler. Yeah? So this is this contraction of the assignment chains that would remove the T. And you see here, in that sense, really, at least you can kind of make statistics. You see that the stores have not decreased, but the loads have could be decreased by 2. The multiplications could be removed completely. The additions, the number of additions has shrunk because they were in the address arithmetic. That has kind of been compressed. And the comparison could not be optimized. But the assignments again have, where the number of assignments has shrunk, and by that, this swap routine has become much more efficient. Which for the swap alone, it is not so important. But if you think of that, this swap is kind of the procedure which is repeatedly called during the all the way, all the time. During the sorting, then this is if we gained a factor of 2 here, then this makes our sorting routine essentially a factor of 2 faster. Okay, so are there any questions to that? Then we would kind of start with a first look at this, the first kind of optimization, and what was there? The philosophical principle. The philosophical principle was, if there is a computation which is completely useless, please remove it. Huh? And now, in general, this is a. In general, it's not so clear whether we can always detect whether a computation is really completely superfluous. But in some cases, we can. And so here is, for example, one situation where we can. This is when we have a value, and that is computed several times. And in fact, if you think of our swap example, there was this address computation. This was done several times. And that is something which we would like to remove. We could do it in such a way. Now, how can we do it? Well, one possibility is if the value is computed several times. Okay, so at least to remove the second computation of the same value, we would at least have to store the value which we have already computed. So in that sense, it is not completely true to say that we have removed the computation, but we have replaced it by a store. And, by store, and afterwards by a load. Yeah, from that, variable. So in that sense, already at that point, if the computation which we compute is just an addition, it might already be a little bit questionable whether it is worthwhile to save an addition or to replace an addition by a store and a load. And sometimes addition is faster. So there's there are kind of negotiations to make, but at least that is the general principle. Instead of recomputing, we kind of store and we kind of tabulate, if you like. So that means further computation is a lookup. And the general technique by which helps in this way is called availability. So the general analysis which uses that is called availability of expressions in this case. This is, by that you find it in the literature, and the transformation to do this optimization is sometimes called redundancy elimination. Yeah, so one could therefore also write, instead of superfluous, redundant. And this general principle of avoiding recomputing of values is sometimes people use it also in algorithms design. And it is sometimes called memorization, and a particular instance of that is perhaps dynamic programming, if you like. Dynamic programming is kind of, you have a recursive procedure with a lot of recursive procedure calls, and you kind of tabulate the calls which you already have computed. And then it happens that later in another branch of your recursion, the same call will occur again. You could recompute it, but then everything is exponential. But you could also look it up if you have computed it already, and then things suddenly start to be polynomial. Where is this dynamic programming principle? Have you an example for that? What? The knapsack problem, well, that is exponential. I think they use dynamic programming there as well. That's true. Another problem? The coin problem? So I don't know that. What is it?
You want to split the amount of money to some kind of coins.
Ah.
You can do it.
So you have several coins and you have an amount and you want to kind of do this amount by means of the... But that is kind of related to the knapsack problem, I guess. It's a disguise of the knapsack problem. There's another, perhaps, you know, in passing... When you do the Cook-Younger-Kazami thing, so that is in some sense also an example of dynamic programming.
Optimal binary tree is also.
Which one?
Optimal binary tree.
Optimal binary trees. So there are several. So it's a general principle. People use it for various applications, but that's again. Instead of recomputing, you tabulate. You kind of store the value which you have, and that we will see how that works in for these expressions. But I guess in 1 minute we will not kind of solve the problem completely. And so I guess we stop for today and continue next Monday. Thank you very much.